WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Chronicles New York's downtown art scene in her short stories. Her stories have been published in periodicals as diverse as The New Yorker, Interview Magazine, Harper's, and Spin. They're now collected in a new anthology titled Slaves of New York. Janowitz's stories are populated with self-absorbed artists and with people who do one thing and consider themselves as doing something else, like waitresses who are actresses and Xeroxers who are novelists. There are stories about one prosperous artist who paints characters based on good and evil using cartoon characters like Babalooey and Bullwinkle, and another, a starving artist whose ambition is to go to Rome to construct the chapel of Jesus Christ as a woman adjacent to the Vatican. Several of Janowitz's stories have been optioned by Andy Warhol, who's planning to base a movie on them. Tema Janowitz was born in San Francisco and grew up in Massachusetts. She studied at Barnard, the Yale School of Drama, and Columbia. Her first novel, American Dad, was published in 1981 when she was 24. This fall, she'll be a writer in residence at Princeton University. Slaves of New York is published by Crown, and she'll read a story from it in just a couple of minutes. Tema Janowitz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Let me ask you to describe the part of the New York art scene that you're chronicling in your stories.
Well, I guess I'm writing about people that live downtown that are somewhat involved in the arts, which means they don't have to get up and go to a 9-to-5 job. They might have hair salons or design jewelry or musicians and fashion designers, and they're people that spend a lot of their waking hours in nightclubs or at restaurants in their daylight hours sleeping or maybe working on some art.
Do you think of yourself as an insider or an outsider in that scene?
I always felt like an outsider, and I always went to nightclubs and thought, gee, everybody looks like they're having a really great time, and how come I can't be one of the gang? I didn't realize when I was in high school and there was all these cliques, I thought when I finished high school it would be over, but it turned out that high school was going to go on for your entire life with different cliques that you never get to be a member of. And well, finally, it dawned on me that a lot of things that were making people be friends with each other was that they would go in the bathroom and take drugs, and that did lend a certain camaraderie to the relationships. But I couldn't take drugs because they made me sick, so I had to think of why else I could be friends with everybody, but I somehow didn't get to be. Anyway, I just took notes, and then I went home and wrote my stories about them. But now I do have some friends.
Well, I guess you're actually even celebrated in that scene now for having written about it.
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, I'm not sure anybody reads, but there still are people that they celebrate.
That's right. You don't have to have your work read to be a celebrity anymore.
No.
Does it mean anything to you to have become accepted by the people whose acceptance you so much wanted a few years ago?
Well, it's awfully nice. They were just coming to Philadelphia. It was a really big thrill for me, and I mean, it's like I'm living in one tiny room in New York with two dogs, and the place is so small that I have to have a folding-out sofa for a bed. And then I got to Philadelphia, and Crown had arranged for – Crown's my publisher, and they had arranged for a driver, and they put me up in a really fancy hotel. But then before I went to sleep, I turned on the TV, and there was a video of what to do in case of a fire. And in the middle of the night at 5:30, the fire alarm went off. And I tried to remember what I had seen on the video about what to do in case of a fire, and one thing was you're supposed to feel the door. So I did go and feel the door, and then I opened the door, and all that up and down the hall, everybody was looking out, and there didn't seem to be any fire. So I went back and dialed the operator, which was the second thing the video said you were supposed to do, and the operator told me, oh, everything's fine, we were just testing the equipment. Which seemed a little far-fetched to me at 5:30 in the morning. Something else must have been going on. But the whole thing just goes to show that even when you get to stay in a hotel and have a driver, you're still going to get woken up in the middle of the night by something.
That's right, even if it's not police sirens or your next-door neighbor being robbed. What makes the characters in your stories slaves of New York?
Well, I think that I was thinking of different types of reasons. I mean, people come to New York from all over the country that are misfits in their hometown. They didn't fit in there and they couldn't be accepted, so they thought, I'll go to New York and I'll make it and I'll show them all. Well, this isn't something recent. This has been going on since the 30s, maybe. We have Judy Garland in the movies coming to New York and going to make it and being a Broadway actress. But people are slaves to New York because they want to make it, and that's the place that's the capital of the arts. Let's say if you're a painter, that's where the hottest galleries are or the most current galleries in the museums. Some people are slaves to their careers for other reasons. If you want to be a high-powered Wall Street broker, lawyer, you come to New York. And some people are slaves to their relationships. They're with somebody that has to be in New York for one reason or other, and they can't leave. And some people are slaves to their apartments. They inherited an apartment from their sister 10 years ago, and the rent is low, and they know if they leave, they'll lose this valuable find. And so there's all different types of reasons for being a slave. I was writing about the downtown group of art people in the arts.
One of the slave reasons that you mentioned is apartments and how high the costs of apartments are. It seems that in Manhattan, people have created these crazy living arrangements just to be able to afford to have a place to live. And you have characters like that in your stories.
Yeah, well, like sometimes a couple will live together, and when they split up, neither of them can afford to move out. So they're trapped permanently bonded to each other because neither of them can really negotiate a new rent or a new lease. And sometimes flimsy walls go up, dividing what was once a small room into two even smaller ones.
You write that it was hard not to live in New York and be full of rage. Do you feel that way yourself? Does being in New York sometimes make you really angry?
Yes, because you can't really walk out on the street without something happening that sort of either makes you frightened or angry. And on my block, a building collapsed recently. I guess that make you a little jumpy. Some people were putting up a new building and the whole thing just suddenly sunk down. And, well, across from my apartment, there's a transvestite prostitute corner. So there's like 10 transvestites. They sleep out in the summer on this sort of plank high-rise. Not a high-rise, but like some sort of loading dock. And I don't mind the transvestites sleeping there, but they stay up all night and listen to the radio, and it's really noisy. And I don't know what else happens. A lot of stuff happens all the time, but the thing is that sometimes somebody might do something like slam a door in your face or knock you over, but you really don't want to say to them, hey, that wasn't a good thing that you do, because they might take out their gun and shoot you. Even recently, there was the man that went berserk on the Staten Island Ferry and slashed a lot of people with a sword. And I went down to the Motor Vehicle Bureau a few days later to try and replace my license, and the line was like 2 hours long. And all of a sudden, a man on another line got angry and started yelling, and everybody just sort of began cowering. They practically threw themselves flat on the ground. I'm sure they were all thinking that it was another berserk person with a sword or some sort of mutilating device.
What are the payoffs? What makes it worth staying for you?
Well, for me, as a writer, locked up in my room all day, looking at the typewriter, it's wonderful to go to the window and look out and see life and activity and action. And it's wonderful to walk out on the street with my dogs and people stop and have conversations. I can go to coffee shops. And it's all kind of life coming to me. I'm not in the middle of nowhere waiting for my flowers to blossom, which would also be very nice, but which is not that much of a contrast after looking at a typewriter. And, I mean, there's always plays and movies and everything that's the latest, because it does seem like things, a lot of trends start in New York and then move out to the rest of the country. But then you find after you've been in New York for a while, you don't really take that much advantage of it.
My guest is Tamma Janowitz, and her short stories that have just been collected in a new book titled Slaves of New York. I'd like you to read one of the stories for us, and we've chosen a story that's short enough so you could actually read the whole thing.
Okay.
And do you want to read it for us and set it up if you'd like to?
Well, there's not really a setup. It's just called Case History Number 4, Fred, and it's one of the stories in Slaves of New York. Fred had a problem. He liked to approach strange girls on the street and offer to take them shopping at Tiffany's. As he was an out-of-work musician who lived in a cold water walk-up near the Williamsburg Bridge, this often got him into trouble. The first time it happened, he was leaving a Midtown record company. He had gone there to drop off yet another of his tapes. And across the block he saw a tall girl with short, cropped hair and a certain elegant, hard way of walking. He crossed the street against the light and came up alongside the girl. To his surprise, he found himself saying, "Listen, I like your linear definition. I was wondering, just for the hell of it, would you let me take you shopping at Tiffany's? It would give me a great deal of pleasure, and naturally I wouldn't expect payment of any kind." The girl looked at him and said, "Buzz off." If anything, Fred was energized by the experience. A few weeks later, while shopping for artichoke chocolate chip ice cream at Di Roma's in Soho, he saw another girl with skinny elbows and a wry, pixie-ish face. He looked over her shoulder. She was purchasing a can of cream of asparagus soup. "Good choice," he said. "Listen, I know this might offend you, but I'm a millionaire, and I get a kick out of taking young women shopping at Tiffany's. Would you like to go? You can pick out something nice. A bracelet, whatever." "Okay," the girl said. They got in a taxi. On the way uptown, the girl explained that she was from Ohio and was visiting her sister. Fred said that he didn't do this sort of thing all that often, just when the mood struck. "It must be nice to have all that money," the girl said. "Oh, it's not bad," Fred said. In Tiffany's, the girl grew very excited. "I can't believe this," she said. "Wait till my sister hears about this. She'll just die. This is like something out of the movies." For almost an hour, Fred and the girl perused the trays of emerald rings, chunky lapis bracelets, silver and pearl necklaces. Watching the girl with her gingery freckles, her muttered cooing, and her skinny, twitching elbows, Fred was nearly overcome with love. At last, the girl selected a $3,000 belt of alligator and silver. "Very tasteful," Fred said. "A good choice. But don't you think you'd rather have a pin?" The girl looked worried. "Well, it's up to you," she said. "You're paying. I mean, you can decide." Fred knew the girl really wanted the belt, but he selected a tiny choker of pink coral and small diamonds. Just as the salesperson was about to write up the purchase, Fred searched his pockets and his wallet. "Damn," he said. "I've forgotten my credit card. How stupid." The girl looked wistful, but said she understood, absolutely. That night, Fred replayed the event over in his head. He felt he had never been more aroused, more attuned to life, than he had been in that hour and a half spent in Tiffany's. Yet obviously, this was not normal. He remembered reading about how when Nietzsche, the famous German philosopher, was 15 years old and in boarding school, a sadomasochistic nymphomaniac countess snuck into his dorm room late one night, dressed as a man, and beat him until she was sexually aroused enough to make love. Though Fred didn't quite remember all the details of this incident, he did know that in future years, when Nietzsche was grown up, he developed his Superman philosophy, in which the virile, powerful individual would dominate in life and society. In Nietzsche's case, it was obvious how the primary or key event, that of his rape by the blonde nymphomaniac countess, led to the creation of a new philosophy. But Fred could not understand why he himself had this penchant, this need, this lust to approach strange women on the street and offer to take them shopping at Tiffany's. He'd never had a key event. Maybe he'd never had any events. For a few more times, he was able to get away with his harmless ruse. But eventually, the salespeople began to recognize him. And at last, one of them, upon seeing him enter Tiffany's with yet another woman, called the police. He was detained and questioned for several hours, the woman also. She wept bitterly as she explained she had never seen Fred before. Tiffany's decided not to press charges, provided Fred never entered the store again. He thought about asking women to shop with him at Harry Winston's, but his original enthusiasm had worn thin. His pleasure in women had dimmed. Even his new musical compositions seemed to lack the old zip and snap.
That's the story Fred, as read by the author Tama Janowitz, and it's from her collection of stories, Slaves of New York. In that story, he says that the shopping in Tiffany's with a girl who he selected leaves him more aroused and attuned to life than anything else. And it really made me think of, you know, shopping as this almost sexual experience for some people, or the sense of having money as being an almost sexual experience. Have you met a lot of people who react to it that way?
Well, I don't know people with very much money, but it seems like in New York there's not too much else to do a lot of times except for shop. I mean, you can't exactly go out and enjoy nature, and I guess that leaves shopping.
Shopping's really been so elevated lately. Did you see the film 9 1/2 Weeks?
No.
Well, it's supposed to be about this somewhat sadomasochistic sexual relationship, but what they really spend half of their time doing is eating and shopping, which seems to be even more sensual to them than tying each other up and fondling each
but
other.
Shopping
does.
Is really one of the most grueling experiences anybody could ever have to endure. So,
well, I would endorse
that. That's the S&M part. Yeah.
Yes, I see. I see what you mean. How did you get to New York? You were born in San Francisco. You grew up in Massachusetts.
Yes.
What brought you there? Did you have this, if I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere's attitude?
I didn't get accepted to college anyplace else. And I guess I must have wanted to go to New York, or I wouldn't have applied to Barnard as one of the colleges that I wanted to go to. But when I got there, I liked New York a lot, and I liked the energy and excitement of it, and I could major in writing at Barnard, and I was afraid that if I did major in English and I had to write papers, I'd flunk out. And so I did creative writing. But then I left New York and Barnard, and I tried to work for a while, and I worked in advertising, but unfortunately, they didn't bother to find out when they gave me the job that I had no art training, and I was hired as an assistant art director, and I had no talent or skill for drawing at all. I got the job because I used to draw little weird posters of strange things, but that's a lot different than trying to draw a cowboy that looks like John Wayne going into a bar and ordering a can of Underwood deviled ham on a storyboard. So then they tried to have me do other things besides draw, but I proved that I was incompetent at anything. So then I got laid off, and I went back to school to concentrate on writing because I knew then that I wasn't cut out for a 9-to-5 job. And then I went back to New York after a while, and I forget what the question was. I forget what I'm saying. I don't know. I've managed to exist marginally, but keep on writing, which is what I always wanted to do.
You had, what was it called, an internship, an apprenticeship or something with Mademoiselle magazine?
Oh, yes, it was a big prize, and it was the last year of it when I graduated college. But a lot of us had read The Bell Jar, the Sylvia Plath book, in which she described her nightmare of being a Mademoiselle guest editor under altered name of the magazine. But it didn't deter anyone. We all kept applying for it, and I won it. I was one of 12 that won it, and I worked on the magazine for a month. But one day they sent me out on a fashion shoot, and they asked me to iron a blouse, and I burned it up. I put the iron down on it, and the whole sleeve melted, and I burned the whole thing up. So then I burst into tears, and I knew that I wasn't meant to work on a magazine.
What about your sensibility? Did it mesh with the sensibility of Mademoiselle magazine? Did you feel like you belonged there?
Everyone looked so grown up, and they had clothing, and I don't know. I've never felt like I fit in anywhere. I can't say it's about a woman's magazine. I just never felt like I could somehow fit in.
When you first started this, well, I'm thinking of one of the characters in your story who, in the first, she's a recurring character in the first few stories that she's in. She is considered in the scene to be the girlfriend of the artist, and because of that, she's pretty much on the periphery of things because she's not the artist herself, and she knows a lot of people secondhand through him, and that's how she gets her entree. Were you ever in that position yourself before you were known for your own work?
I've gone out with a lot of artists, and the art world always interested me. And the business of art and how young artists are taken up by a dealer and created and how their paintings go up in value and the economic structure of the art world and how once their paintings are collected by enough prestigious collectors, the value of their paintings isn't going to go back down because the collectors don't want to lose their investment. And I was very interested in the whole economic setup of the downtown art scene. And when I first came back to New York, that was in 82, the whole East Village scene had not yet started, but I didn't know anybody in New York, but I knew that if I went down to Soho on a Saturday, there would be art openings, and you could walk into them off the street, and it'd be like a cocktail party for 1,000, and you didn't have to be invited. You could just walk in and start meeting people and drinking some sort of horrible wine. So that was sort of something that interested me, that whole art scene.
But you, unlike your character, weren't in the position of being the girlfriend of the artist?
No, I mean, I've had boyfriends, and I think the things that Eleanor goes through are certainly things that that I've been through and that all my girlfriends have been through in a way of trying to figure out what your role is as somebody's girlfriend in this day and age when we don't really have any role models for how to behave as women. And there is still a double standard. If you're male in New York and an artist or involved in the arts, you do have, I think, an easier time of it. There are more galleries showing men than there are women. And we also, I don't know what I was going to say. I mean, it's tough to be somebody's girlfriend. The men do have more prestige most of the time, and you're supposed to have a career, but you want a relationship too, and you put up with a certain amount of stuff because you don't want to lose this relationship, but how much do you put up with? It's till it finally gets to the point where you think, I can't put up with this anymore, even if it means losing this relationship, which, you know, is sort of what happens to Eleanor in a way.
Yeah, you mentioned that you think men have more status sometimes in the art world in New York, and there's a character in one of your stories who's a dealer who only deals with, the dealer's a woman, but she only deals with male artists. And there is, in fact, a gallery owner in New York who's been accused of doing that, whether it's intentional or not, of only having male clients.
Well, quite a few. In fact, there was this group called the Guerrilla Girls, and they put up posters all around town and listing the museums and the art dealers that only were showing men and not showing women. But then these girls got a show of their own at the Palladium. And then I forget what happened.
And then one of them came on Fresh Air as a guest.
And did she say what happened?
Well, they're still working at it, I guess. I mean, they're still organizing. They have local branches they're trying to form in different cities and things like that. Well, do you think that there's much of a place for feminism in the scene as you describe it?
I don't know. I think we're talking to somebody whose basic struggle was like for survival and how I was going to pay the rent, and the people I know are sort of trying to survive, and I don't really know what that means in terms of just living day to day. Like, I know women put up with a hell of a lot in their relationships with men, but the basic conclusion is that men are sort of similar to dogs, and you can train them to a certain point, but you can't expect them to talk. I mean, dogs, that is. I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know what the role is of feminism in downtown New York. It's really like,
I guess this is my very circuitous way of saying that I was wondering if you think that feminism is relevant to the kind of inequities that you feel like you've faced both personally and professionally, or if it seems out of date, as some people have suggested it might be. I was wondering if you had a take on that for yourself.
I don't know. I can only speak for myself. I know when I was first writing, and I wrote American Dad, and it's written from a male point of view. I didn't want to write from a female point of view. It was more interesting to me to write from a male point of view. Anyway, I sent out parts of the novel, and they came back to me immediately. And then I thought, well, it's a man's point of view, and it's first person. So I sent it out under the name Tom A. Janowitz, and one part was immediately bought by the Paris Review, and an editor that was a woman on a magazine who had previously rejected the same stuff under my name, now, while she didn't accept the stories, began to write to Tom A. Janowitz and ask him out to lunch when he was in New York. So I don't feel that in some ways things have changed that much since George Eliot was writing under, had to write under a man's name, and Emily Bronte writing under Currer Bell, I think that was her pseudonym. And on some level, things haven't changed. In other levels, they have changed a great deal, and I don't think we feel like there's no choice besides marriage and children. And there are more options, though things still aren't good.
My guest is writer Tama Janowitz, and her short stories have just been collected in a new book, which is titled Slaves of New York. There are women in some of your stories who, and men too, who are just very absorbed in wearing the right thing and in fashion and everything. And one of your stories has a woman in it who gets her legs waxed and compares it to pain as bad as an abortion and describes what it's like and really hates it, yet goes through with it. And I wonder if you've felt in that kind of bind yourself of thinking that fashion is on the one hand kind of absurd and puts you through a lot of pain, on the and on the other hand has to be done.
I've had my legs waxed. I mean, there's a lot of fun with fashion. I remember being in London in the mid-70s, and everybody was dressed up like they were in a costume, and it was great to look out on the street, and people seemed to be able to act out their fantasies through clothing, which seemed certainly a harmless enough thing to do and most entertaining to look at. I mean, as far as fashion goes in New York, it's something that in many ways is something to make you want to buy more things, and magazines are working with marketing people and designers to create something new to sell for the next year so you go out and spend money. On the other hand, there's a lot of young designers that don't do expensive things that are having fun doing it. And I mean, as for myself, I wear a lot of black sweatshirts because they don't show any dirt and they're real cheap and everything. And I don't really have time to think about clothes that much because I'm too busy walking my dogs and sitting at the typewriter. But I don't feel like I'm a real expert in any subject except maybe the different characters in the book.
Well, I was interested by your own picture on the back of the book because it's you wearing red silk Chinese pajamas and you're lying on a bed that has a peach brocaded spread on it, and then there's like a rose and blue fabric behind you, and it's a and you're wearing like red lipstick, and it's very, very sumptuous, really. And you have your two terriers nestled against you.
Yeah.
And it struck me as being a very like 1950s celebrity
It was really
photo
fun to do it. Yeah, it was absolutely fun to do it because my friend had painted this portrait of me, which is on the front cover, when we were back at Provincetown. He was a painter there, and that Provincetown is like a place where artists and writers can go and live and write for a year. And I was a writer there, so he painted this sort of reclining Maha Odalesque portrait of me, which we use on the cover. So in the back, we decided to do a spoof of the front. And I had these pajamas because there was a party at a nightclub one night that was a pajama party. And for some reason, I felt that I was going to go to this party and I was going to wear pajamas. So I went with a girlfriend in the middle of summer to Chinatown, where she managed not to paint and I managed not to write for an afternoon by going around to the cheap stores and looking for pajamas. And then I remember we had lunch. We went into one of these dim sum places, and you can order different food off the trays that they bring around to you. And everything tasted like fish. It was so disgusting. Everything had the most horrible fishy flavor. And after one bite, we were so nauseous that we decided we could make a lot of money on this as a new diet because you just totally lost your appetite on this horrible Chinese food. So anyway, I had these pajamas. Then when the photographer came over, she brought some old pieces of cloth she had around her apartment, and we threw them over my couch. And then I posed, and I had a big kick out of it.
So the whole thing was kind of tongue-in-cheek?
I don't know how it couldn't be. I think if you look on the rest of the cover, you can see my gym socks sticking out from underneath the Chinese satin pajamas. I mean, it'd be hard to do something without like that without being kind of ironic about it.
Does it ever create a conflict for you to, on the one hand, want to go to the clubs and go to restaurants and hang out, and on the other hand, be home typing, which is your work?
Well, a lot of the reviews that have come out about my book have criticized me a great deal for going to nightclubs, but I mean, I'm sorry that I went to a nightclub, but sometimes I do go out and look at nightclubs, and it seemed to me that that there was a whole world out there, and there was people that were enthralled with going out, and there was a whole scene, and thousands of people are going out to these places. Now, why? Each writer looks for some sort of world or territory that they can cover, and for Faulkner, it was, you know, Yakno, whatever you say, county. And for Bobby Ann Mason, it's like the shopping malls, people going to shopping malls in Kentucky. And maybe you don't stay with that forever, but for me, at this moment, that whole world interested me a great deal. And what's going on is that people are trying to connect with each other. And that's what's really going on. But the other level is that it's a noisy nightclub with people staying up way too late. And how they stay up is to take some drugs or I don't know what the hell, they sleep all day. And there's this desperation because nobody really is connecting with anybody else. But yet there's this strong desire to. And the whole dichotomy is what really interested me.
Several of your stories have been optioned by Andy Warhol for a movie that he intends to make. Are you going to have any input in that? Are you going to write the screenplay or anything like that?
I'll be involved in the project, and Andy's been really great because he got so excited about this, and it was the first thing he had decided to make into a movie since 1977 when he made Bad, but we're still talking at the moment. I mean, I think maybe it'll go into production next summer. And I don't know if I want to write the whole screenplay or just come in on a collaborative basis, because it's hard as a writer when you write a story and you rewrite a story. And then the Stosh and Eleanor stories that Andy bought were in The New Yorker, so I went over the galleys there and then went over them when they came out in the book. So at a certain point, you just think, can I really deal with these characters anymore and please let them die? But I know I'll be involved to a lesser, greater degree in the whole thing. I think it'll be really fun because I don't think anybody's done it right in the movies yet.
Done what right?
The downtown New York art scene, and it's usually been done from sort of a more Hollywood point of view, which I want to go to a movie and see real people leading lives, either that I get to like look at voyeuristically or that I have some identification with, and I don't want some Hollywood plotted thing that's like a parody of itself. I want to see something with real people with real feelings. And that's what I hope came through in the stories.
Yeah. Well, good luck with your writing and with the movie and everything. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on this. I know I'm totally incoherent much of the time, but I can't seem to do anything about it.
You feel incoherent?
I don't know, because I'm not listening to myself.
Hmm. Well, I thought you were very interesting. Thank you very much for being here. My guest has been writer Tamma Janowitz, and she has a new collection of short stories that have just been published. It's a collection of stories that were originally in places like Interview Magazine and Harper's and The New Yorker. The new collection is called Slaves of New York, and it's published by Crown. The author's name again is Tamma Janowitz, and thanks again for being with us. This is Fresh Air. It's 24 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up at about 4 o'clock, we're going to be joined by writer Harvey Pekar, and he's the creator and writer of the American Splendor comic book series. And it's a series of autobiographical comic books that's illustrated by several artists, including Art Crumb. And they're about Harvey Pekar's life. He lives in Cleveland. He, for about 19 years, has worked as a hospital clerk. Before that, he was a jazz collector and jazz critic, published in places like Coda and Downbeat magazine. And he describes his comics as adult comics. So he'll be with us at about 4 o'clock on Fresh Air. Right now, we're going to hear from the Bobs, which is a four-member group from San Francisco, and they've become known for what they call new wave a cappella music. They write songs which are as influenced by heavy metal as they are by rhythm and blues, and their vocal imitations of instruments like electric guitar, zoom bass, and synth drum set them apart from more traditional doo-wop groups. The Bobs' first and only album was released in 1983 by Kaleidoscope Records. Last year, the Bobs sang in our music studio and discussed their work with 91FM's Bob Carlin, no relation. They began by singing an original composition.
Why We've been together a month now. They invited us to dinner. I didn't know it meant the night. I helped with the dishes.